It's time to step into the Coming Out Lounge, a cool, safe space to be true to your sexual self, with your host, Rick Clemens. Rick has helped hundreds of people come out of the closet, and now each week he's bringing you cool insights for loving and accepting yourself, boosting your self-confidence, and living a guilt-free, purpose-filled life on the other side of the closet doors. Cuddle up with yourself and get ready for heartwarming coming out stories, ideas for living authentically, and tips for being fully self-expressed. Now here's your host, Coming Out Coach Rick.
Hey there, Closet Busters. It is that time once again for you to come out and step out, step up, and step into living your powerful LGBTQ and all the rest of the alphabet truth on the Coming Out Lounge today. And today we're going to go to Hollywood. In fact, I'm sure most of you have heard about Hollywood's dirty little secrets, everything from who's screwing who to the latest facelifts and boob jobs. But there's really a dirty little secret that is starting to come out of the closet, that it is okay to be gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, all those beautiful labels that we have. It's okay to be that in the entertainment business. But there's a lot of people in the business who aren't closeted. And today's guest is one of those exceptions. From his world of being on VH1, the BBC, NBC, Out TV, and Logo, to shows like Dante's Cove and Bump, to films like Mulligan's and I'm a Porn Star, Charlie David has consciously, truly consciously been out of the closet in the entertainment industry without remorse. But the question is, how do you get to this space within yourself to be completely unapologetic about who you are? Well, we're going to ask him, and we're going to bring all that forward today as we explore what it's like to be out behind and in front of the camera on the Coming Out Lounge. Welcome to the show, Charlie David. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here today.
Hey, thanks for taking time. I know you're busy filming right now in Canada on some new stuff, and I just appreciate you giving us the pleasure of your time today, because I think you've got a beautiful story to share with anyone who is in the closet, starting to come through those doorways, on the other side of the closet, of just being truly authentically who you are. So let's kind of dive in with that. I mean, I know you've been on numerous entertainment shows, as I said in the intro. How did you really start to step into just saying, this is me, this is how I'm going to be in life, this is how I'm going to show up? Was there anything particular that kind of nudged you there, or have you always just been, this is who I am?
No, I don't think I've always been in as comfortable a place as I am today. That's for sure. I think, you know, most of us who feel different in any way go on a terrific journey to self-acceptance. Mm-hmm. And mine really started, I mean, I knew that there was things that were different about me from a young age. I remember at 5 years old looking at my swim coach and thinking, wow, I really like the tan on his shoulders and chest. He's really handsome, you know?
Yeah.
Or, you know, at 12, other experiences, kind of looking and going, oh, that guy on my hockey team is attractive to me. Why? And at 16 years old, I came out. I was living in small town Saskatchewan in Canada, and in my province of about a million people, I didn't know anybody else who, you know, associated themselves with any letter other than S for straight.
Right.
So there weren't mentors at that point for me. And, you know, it was also just pre-internet, pre the era of a lot of representations of people like us in the media. And so it was a bit of a leap, you know, when I came out to friends and family. I had a bag packed. I thought I would be, you know, at 16 years old, getting on a Greyhound bus for who knows where, but I didn't think I'd be able to stay. And I was shocked, really, at how accepting people were. And of course, it wasn't an immediate thing on their part, because, you know, for myself, I'd been wrestling with this idea of I'm different, I'm gay, that's okay, for years. You know, and probably, you know, from when I mentioned looking at my swim coach at 5 years old up until the point where I was 16, 11 years of questions and reflecting and kind of taking stock of who I was as this different person. So for my friends and family, of course, it took them some time too to step back and go, oh, okay, what does this mean, and get their heads around it as well. But, you know, overall, I remember my dad, both my mom and dad came down to my room because I had how it all came down. We were at the dinner table and my mom was saying, why do you watch Melrose Place, you know, garbage in, garbage out on television?
Right.
And yet she's come around to be quite proud of some of the work I've done, which is kind of funny. But I remember very dramatically saying, you don't understand, my life is Melrose Place. Mm-hmm. And at that time, at 6 years old, it felt like it. I had, you know, a girlfriend who was contemplating having an abortion. I had other friends who were sleeping behind each other's back. I was queer. Mm-hmm. And so it felt like this generational divide. So I ran down to my room crying and mom and dad came down. And I think they thought that maybe one of my close girlfriends was pregnant or something.
Sure.
And when I came out, dad kind of brushed it off and he said, well, you know, this might be a phase. When I was in college, all types of things happened and left me with a few question marks about my dad. Mm. And my mom, who I thought would be more accepting, she was the one that the next day on my desk was the Bible with it like indexed to the references. And I was like, oh my gosh, mom. Like, we grew up quite religious and I knew them by heart. I knew where they were. I had struggled with them. I, in that moment, certainly didn't need my mom to put it in my face and remind me.
Right.
But, you know, she and all of us as a family have just really maintained open communication lines. No question is a bad question. And I think that's how we've got to a place of full acceptance, love, and support. And at this point, you know, there's no difference between me or any of my siblings.
And how many siblings do you have?
Two and two.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, two brothers, two sisters. I'm the second oldest.
Wow. So, you know, it's interesting you brought up this conversation with your dad, and those are always the weirdest conversations. I remember my father alluding to something similar, and I'm like, really? We're having this kind of weird, strange conversation, you know? And it kind of made me feel uneasy because it's like, okay, so is this what my path's going to be? Which it kind of was. I ended up coming out at 19. And then my parents taking a stand and saying, no, you can't be this. And I went through kind of not coming out therapy, but, you know, not the religious gay X stuff, but counseling with a pastor, all this stuff. And those who listen to the show kind of know that story, that it didn't work because I, you know, kind of like your swim coach, I kept going to the pastor for the counseling. All I could do is sit there and go, well, he's really hot. So, you know,
yeah,
this isn't working, you know. But yeah, it was kind of an interesting space to go through that with my dad. Now, my mom was fairly more accepting in ways, but then now it's kind of like it flips back and forth, and I don't have the best relationship right now with my parents still around this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So was there any particular sibling that challenged you? I mean, did you have any like siblings that like, oh my gosh, this doesn't work for me, or were they more accepting than your parents?
Well, I think with each of them in different ways, you know, like with my younger siblings, I remember one of my sisters, Colleen, is 6 years my junior. So when I was coming out at 16, she was 10. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for a while, for probably a year, I hadn't told her because I thought, well, you know, she's like, what's it going to mean to her at 10 years old? And I kind of, you know, held back. But we were out walking one day and she said, oh, that's so gay, you know, in a derogatory way. And I stopped and I said, Colleen, you know, do you know what that means? And when you say that in that way, with that tone, it makes me feel bad. It's an insult. And then after that, you know, again, she totally came around. My older brother was and still is Canadian military. And I remember one time I was living in LA. I was probably about 18 or 19 years old. And he was coming down for some training around San Diego. And he was getting together with some buddies and asked me, you know, you're welcome to come over, blah, blah, blah. And at the end of the phone call, he said, you know, if you don't mind, just like, don't mention, you know, don't talk right. about that.
Right.
I was so excited to see my brother. And in that moment, his, you know, wanting for some self-preservation in the eyes of his peers just made me feel worthless. Mm-hmm. It totally devalued all the excitement I had to see my brother. And I think it probably was coming from a place of concern and love from him as well. It wasn't only self-preservation. It was probably him wanting to make sure that I didn't feel awkward and that I didn't have any moments
sure.
of strangeness, you know. But I think we have to be so empathetic with each other sometimes, right? Because it's not only us in the queer community. all of us have things that make us feel different or vulnerable, right?
Yeah,
and to just try and be mature and open enough to recognize that in each other, I think can go a long way.
Well, I think empathy is key here. And I think sometimes as we come into our gay selves or lesbian or bisexual, transgender, whatever it is for us, it can become very disheartening to try to be empathetic towards quote unquote the others, because we've been preparing for this and we've been exploring this. And then suddenly most of us like, okay, I did this big thing. Now I want people to really embrace me. What we forget when I speak with my panels, when I do a lot of work with PFLAG, when we're on panels, I talk about this empathy piece a lot, because you got to give room for the other people to step into the empathetic place. And I challenge people to be empathetic themselves. Mom, dad, brothers, sisters, you know, whoever it is in your circles, they just got handed something that they may not know what to do with. So be really, be very empathetic about that. Then on the flip side, it's really hard to be empathetic. You don't feel like that's being returned in kind. So it puts us in that interesting, weird dilemma of, okay, I really want to try to do this. But sometimes we have to take the deep breath and be the bigger people and really just say, okay, for now, I may have to be the bigger person until such a time. You just go, I can't do this any longer. I've tried to be the bigger person and I'm going to be empathetic that I need to step away and maybe they need to step away. And then sometimes that's the only way to get through this. So let's kind of roll forward. You you get into doing these beautiful pieces of work you're doing, acting and producing and all this stuff. And there seems to be a consistent thread of a lot of LGBT subtext, predominantly gay subtext in a lot of your work. How did you finally say, okay, I'm going to just allow myself to be this way in a world, as I said in the intro, in a world where it's kind of still that dirty little secret, you know, what was that impetus for you to say, I can take this stand and just be this guy in the entertainment industry?
It really was, I viewed it as kind of a mission. Like, this is the job that I'm going to do. I knew when I was deciding to come out, which was like come out publicly in my career.
Yep.
And it only happened in a way because at about 25 years old, I was doing things that I knew would suddenly, I was going to be asked about it.
Yep.
My previous kind of TV work, it wasn't relevant, my sexuality, but I was cast on Dante's Cove with Here TV, which was the flagship show on the new gay network in the USA, and simultaneously cast as the host of Bump, which was an LGBTQ world travel show that was first on Here TV and Out TV in the States and then moved to Logo. But it was really with Dante's Cove. I mean, I stepped on that set and I knew, I mean, there was like, you know, Instinct magazine was there, Genre was there, all the queer media outlets. And I thought, here's the moment, you know, because the question's going to come up and this will define moving forward. Mm-hmm. And up until that point, I had, of course, you know, agent and manager guiding me saying, be wary, know that if you do, it's going to change things. You're going to lose roles. The types of things you go out for are going to change. But I thought, you know what? I have to do this. I had no role models growing up in Saskatchewan, you know, as a youngster. And I thought, no, we need to do this. And I look at other people who had came out a little bit later in life and have been very successful, you know, Sir Elton John or Ellen and others who have had a bit of a rockier journey, like Rupert Everett, for example, who kind of top of the field and then came out and then, you know, still working, but it was a different game.
Yep.
And certainly my game changed when I came out. I mean, I was lucky enough that those two shows, Bump did 6 seasons and Dante's Cove did 3. So I, you know, I had plenty of work for a number of years. But in the off season from those shows, the only things I was being called for were suddenly the hairdresser, you know, kind of stereotypical queer roles. Whereas before that wasn't the case. So it was a game changer, but I decided to just run with it, you know, and now doing a lot of documentary work and stuff, and even the scripted things that I've written, I just keep coming back to it. I guess it's like, it's my area of curiosity. I still like to explore who I am as well as others and their view in this movement. So becoming an activist while being a, you know, in the entertainment industry, I haven't been able to successfully unravel those two.
Yeah. Yeah. So Dante's Cove and everything was what, about 10 years ago at this point, 6 years ago?
Yeah. 2005.
2005. So yeah, it's a little over 10 years ago at this, well, 11 years ago. So yeah. I'm curious, just not that we can look in the crystal ball, but what do you think would have been different if all that was happening now in this day and age?
Oh gosh. Well, I just don't think it would be a big deal at all. I mean, it was kind of this curious time where on Dante's Cove, where like first season, all the performers were straight except me, you know, or at least like vocally, which was a curious thing to be on this like big gay show. And I'm the only out actor, you know, on it. But I think that was like at the beginning when suddenly it was looked at as brave to take on a gay role. We had people like, you know, Tom Hanks was doing it in Philadelphia. And I mean, there was like, you know, Pacino had done it. And like, there was a few spattering, you know, kind of through the 80s and 90s. But suddenly, it was that time of like Brokeback Mountain and stuff. And it was like, if you want to cut your teeth as an actor, you better play gay.
Well, yeah, everybody was kind of dipping their wiki in the water, so to speak. It's like, okay, let's see what happens if we actually push ourselves into this and see how society starts to react. And so, yeah, I think it would be a very different thing. And of course, now today we're seeing so much more of all of this everywhere.
My gosh, it's, yeah, like I was at the gym yesterday and Troy Sivan with his, you know, his song Youth, and I was watching the music video, and it's just, it's so gay all over the, like, you know, it's queer, it's lesbian. Yeah. It's like, it's just like, and I think that's the biggest thing. It's like young people now are not feeling any pressure to even identify, to grab any label, you know?
And well, I agree with you. And I see it in my own kids, because I have two kids. I have a 21-year-old and a 17-year-old, and they get very frustrated by having to identify. It's a very frustrating space. And my youngest one has definitely been more vocal about that because she's into social justice and things such as that. And she has done her own explorations. And when we try to put a label on it, she's like, I don't know why I have to say this is who I am. I'm just who I am, which I find to be very beautiful, quite honestly.
It is.
Things it's to a whole so new level.
But I think for some of us of kind of like my generation and older who felt like we had to go in the trenches a little bit.
Yep.
We had to be brave enough to really come out and choose an identity and stick our feet in the dirt and like come what may, you know, be slapped and turn the other cheek, as you kind of said, and keep turning until you have no cheeks left.
Yep.
At first, it feels like a cop out. You almost want to go, no, damn it. Like, pick something, like pick a letter, you know, like we fought for this. Come on. We fought so you could pick a letter and be out there. But it's moving past that mentality to realize, no, this is the new realm that we're moving into, is this place of complete fluidity and freedom, I hope, which is, as you said, it's absolutely beautiful. It's just a little disconcerting at first for us who are a little bit older.
All right. No, I remember the first time I was on a PFLAG panel, and it was the first time I was sitting really next to a transgender individual. And it was virtually impossible for me to keep from saying him when it was her, but because she had transitioned at age 48, there was all the masculine feature sets there, but very much presented as a woman, has gone through the complete transition. And I remember it was just, I walked out of that, just like almost befuddled myself, going, I can't believe I kept saying him. But it was because my mind hadn't been fully exposed to something like this in the face-to-face, sitting right next to someone. Now, of course, I see her as one of my best friends. We are on panels all together. I just embrace this. You're right. It is a generational thing. And, you know, I'm 50, I'm going to be 53 in a few weeks. And it was very different for me because I came out late in life to start to embrace so much of it. Yet when I came out 2 years later, I met my now husband. And I remember how uncomfortable at times it made him that I was able to be so out. And I don't mean like flamboyant, flailing my hands. Well, I guess every once in a while I do that because I'm a gay man. But he didn't know what to do with it at times when I'd reach over to him, like if we're in Target or somewhere shopping, and say, hey, honey. Or, you know, it was like, wait, he's been through this. you know, all these years of being an out gay man, and he had gone through the hidden closet sort of stuff. And then here I am at 36 years old, you know, calling him honey and sweetie and touching him in public. And this was back in early 2000. So it was still, we were kind of in that weird realm of, okay, where is this all going to go? You said something just a few minutes ago about the thread of where you always come back to and, you know, the work that you do. And I know you're kind of coming back to something in one of your latest work. I'm a porn star gay for pay. So this is kind of the second piece in that work, right? You've already done it. Mm-hmm. I'm a porn star. So what brought you back to doing this documentary? What was the impetus behind that?
To tell you the truth, it was the network, OutTV in Canada, who came and asked me to do it, which is sometimes the case. Sometimes I, you know, I'm often coming up with ideas for new shows and I'm pitching different networks. Yeah. And sometimes they come to me and say, we have this idea. What do you think? Like, would you do it? And I was a bit on the fence about it, to be honest, because I kind of felt like the whole gay for pay conversation was like we were moving beyond it already, that it wasn't on trend right now. But, you know, work is work. And I thought, okay, well, let's dive in here. And I'm glad that I did, because I learned so much again. I mean, I think we are at a very psychologically interesting place in pornography right now, especially in the gay space. Like, for example, probably a solid 80% of crews, like the film crews on these adult shoots, are straight, either men or women, producing gay pornography. The performers, it's even higher. It's like 85 to 90% of them identify as straight. So I think that in itself says something very interesting about who we are as the audience, as gay men. Like, why are we watching? Or is it, you know, the chicken or the egg thing? Is this what's being produced and put in front of us? And so, you know, that's what's being consumed? Or is this actually what we are desirous of? And I think if that's the case, that we're turned off if we hear, you know, a man's voice and it sounds a little too fey or too feminine, and that's not a turn on for us. Or if, you know, one of the performers just reads too gay, then I think we have a lot of internalized homophobia still going on.
No, I agree. I agree 100%. I think there's a lot of internalized homophobia that shows up, especially when we start to see these kind of characters portrayed. And then, you know, suddenly, oh my gosh, this guy's this, or, you know, that woman's that. And then we kind of get up in our stuff around it. I know for me, I went through my own interesting little homophobic journey right after I came out of the closet, where I didn't get the leather scene at all. I didn't get the bear scene. And now, of course, I'm a big guy, so I'm considered a bear, and I used to fight that now. Okay, great. Yes, I'm Big Papa Bear. Come on, bring it on, boys. But I found it really interesting the first time I came across the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgent, and I like flipped. I'm like, this is insane. This isn't what gay is supposed to be about. And then one of my friends pulled me aside and said, literally did that, you know, good friend thing where they grab your shoulders, they're looking you straight in the eyes and said, first of all, you need to calm the fuck down, man. And you need to quit being homophobic. And I wanted to hit him because I'm like, I'm not homophobic. I'm a gay man. He goes, no, you are. And you need to grow into this. You really need to grow into this, because you're going to see a lot of stuff in our gay community that you may not even know exists. And you're going to have to step through this and find your way of being okay with it. You don't have to accept it, but be okay with it and realize this is just an extension of people being who they are in so many ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, I always feel so fortunate to be welcomed into people's lives and living rooms and hearts when I'm directing the documentary, because they're all so generous with me. I mean, I mean, that's what I'm asking of them. But so many people really come to the table. And for example, in this latest doc, I'm a Porn Star Gay for Pay, some of the young guys that I were shooting with, their wives came on board as well. And we interviewed them. And that was super curious to be like, okay, here's this young married couple. And, you know, here's Linda, 100% supporting her man in doing this for, you know, variant reasons. Because, you know, houses are expensive and they want to pay down the mortgage, because, you know, the construction business is really tough in Florida right now, or whatever it is.
Sure.
But it also shows, I think, again, just new wave of acceptance, fluidity, malleability in ideas around sexuality with young people. Because, I mean, you know, most of the people featured in the doc are in their 20s. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, when a young man can go on set, shoot one of these scenes in a day and walk away with, you know, somewhere between $1,000 to $5,000, that's pretty darn good money for a young person who may be struggling or, you know, wanting to put themselves through school and not work a second job that's hours intensive. But there's whole the motivations for getting into it, I think, you know, money is certainly a factor, curiosity for some, exhibitionism for some.
Sure.
You know, it's kind of as wide on the spectrum as each of them are, you know, unique in their personhood as well. But
absolutely,
I would have to say overall, you know, it's the dollar sign is the big driver there.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because we have one of those that lives here in our neighborhood. And I remember the very first time I was going into our local Ralph's grocery store and I saw him and I had to do kind of a double take. And then ironically, my husband said, oh yeah, I see him at the gym all the time. And I'm like, well, why didn't you tell me? I would have started going to that gym, you know? And then before I knew it, he started showing up all over the place. And I'm referring to Cody Cummings. And then the bigger shock to me was the day that I saw him walking with a woman and pushing a baby in a stroller. Mm-hmm. And my whole world just like, oh, wow. I just had to like really go, wow, this is kind of crazy. But then I'm like, wait, why is that crazy? Because you have some construct in your mind, Rick, that says porn stars don't have wives and don't have kids. It's kind of weird to have those thoughts. So yeah, I learned a lot from it. So this documentary is coming out in the next few weeks, right?
Yeah, end of August, August 30th on TV here in Canada. And we'll put it across digital platforms like Vimeo and Amazon and Hulu and Vudu and places like that.
Great. And we're going to have, you know, all the connections on the show page here for people to go check out all this great stuff you're producing. But I want to talk about a couple other things because I want to make sure everybody gets the full spectrum of you and the work that you do. So I have to say that Mulligan's really touches me because it's almost like, to some degree, a mirror of looking at my own life. As I shared with you, I came out late in life at 36. And as I was watching the scenes and the movie and just watching the interaction between you and Dan Payne, I just thought, that is so much my story and so much of the story of the people that I happen to work with as the coming out coach. I built my business on people who came out later in life. So I'm just curious, you know, as you were working through that movie and really doing this, where did you find yourself maybe questioning, being really curious about how people get through this? Was there anything that kind of showed up for you that you didn't expect as you were doing that film?
Yeah, I mean, the inspiration in writing it really came from imagining my future self. You know, I had girlfriends through high school. I kind of bounced back and forth between guys and girls for a while as I was figuring things out. And at one point came to the realization that, you know, I would have a challenging time making a marriage work with a woman if I didn't have a great looking pool boy. And it was either that, you know, a wife would be on board with that or, you know, likely she wouldn't. And I didn't think that was going to be fair. So it was largely just kind of this, you know, reflection on what is my future self? What does that look like? What if I do travel this path and what may be the undoing of me, you know?
Yeah.
And so really I was, you know, Dan Payne's character in the film of Nathan, the father, I mean, you know, I wrote it imagining myself. And then, you know, as most writers do, you pull little things that people say, whether it's a grandmother or a neighbor or a friend, and, you know, they all turn into inspiration for different characters in the narrative that you're telling. You know, it's not a perfect film, but it was my first film. It was my first film that I wrote and I produced. And so I'm very proud of it, and it holds a special place to me for those reasons. But also, as you mentioned, the innumerable people who have come, you know, to me over the years since we did that in like 2008, I think it was released. So it's been, you know, 8 years now. who have said, yeah, you told my story, or I saw myself reflected in that. And that was so rewarding, because as a young man, as I said, growing up with no mentors and not feeling like I had reflections of myself in the media, that's what I set out to do. That was my mission. And I also wanted to make something that I was coming off of Dante's Cove, which, as you know, had a lot of shirtless guys oiled up. And, you know, it was kind of an oversexed show in a way from my, you know, conservative upbringing anyway. And so I wanted to create something that I could sit down with my family and watch, that my grandmother could watch. I mean, you know, my grandma was one of the investors in it. You know, my parents were both on set, you know, driving and doing catering and like helping out wherever they could. It was totally a family affair. And that was the biggest reward. Like, here in Canada, it went on to, the film was licensed to HBO and to Sundance Channel and, you know, several other movie channels that are very mainstream, you know, not just the queer networks. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to create a story that would incite conversations in living rooms where maybe they weren't already happening.
I love that. I love it. You know, and I find this interesting because there's a parallel here that I hear all the time now. When my book came out back in February, I was kind of surprised by the amount of people. Well, I shouldn't say surprised, but I guess I handed it to a lot of my straight friends and said, I want to just give this to you because you've been a part of my life and you've seen this unravel and everything. And I've been amazed by the amount of my heterosexual friends who've come back to me and said, I know this is about your coming out story and how you approach being gay and how you approach coming to terms with everything, but it's really helped me see myself in a whole new light in my own heterosexual self. That was not something I expected to see start to happen. And then simultaneously, I've had a lot of people in our own beautiful LGBTQ community say, really, do we still need to have this conversation about coming out? And I think here's the parallel to what you did with Mulligans. It's the same thing. Do we really still need to have these kind of conversations of people coming out and finding themselves midlife? Yes. Because until it's not happening any longer, then there's no reason to stop having the conversations. And I think this is why you probably have so many people come back to you and say, this really impacted me, because the conversations are still needing to be had.
Totally. And that's why we're so fortunate to live and create in the places that we do. You know, a month ago, I was in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico for a film festival there. And it was, you know, just this little queer festival that's, you know, second year, just kind of starting. And I screened the film Paternity Leave, which is about, you know, in it, myself and my boyfriend, we end up getting pregnant, and it's like, it's happening to men all over the place. And it's really, you know, looking at queer families in a way, in a kind of somewhat comic way. But the audience there was so appreciative of it, but I found it so curious as to why. It was because we were showing family in a normalized way, queer family in a normalized way. And there was one other Mexican film this last year that came out that was queer, and they were just railing against it because, you know, in it, somebody gets HIV and then there's prostitution and there's this and there's that. I reflected on it after and I thought, the reason why they're so upset is because one film was made in Mexico with a queer storyline last year. Wow. That everybody is trying to attach themselves and see themselves reflected in one story. Impossible, right?
It is impossible.
We're at a place now where you're right. We need to continue to create and tell this myriad of stories, because then we can all go, oh, you know, I learned something there. I didn't know that that existed, or some people go through that horrendous thing, or, oh my gosh, I feel supported because this did help, you know, authenticate my own experience. And so I think we're in a fortunate place here in North America and in, you know, some Western countries, but it's really a time to look outward and to support other filmmakers and authors and creators and storytellers in other places as well, where it's still not quite as easy and not as many of their stories are being told.
Yeah. Well, speaking of stories being told, you've got a couple of books that just came out. So you've got Mulligans and you've got Boy Midflight, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Mulligans the first edition came out at the same time as the film.
Right.
And I have a new publisher, you know, put out the new editions of the book, which I was really excited about because it gives them a second life and a new audience. And so Mulligan's in the novel form, for those that have seen the film, it just goes a little bit deeper into each of the characters' perspective about what this is like for them as the family hits this massive challenge of, you know, dad has had an affair and he's maybe gay. And
sure.
How are we dealing with that?
Yeah.
And so it was really fun for me to write because a screenplay is generally, you know, between 85 to maybe 100 pages.
Yep.
With a lot of white space on the pages. It's primarily the dialogue, right?
Yep. Yep.
In novel form, I got to get into the minds of those characters and really, I think, just explore a little bit further and play with some of the characters that didn't end up having as much screen time as I would have liked. You know, some explorations in film inevitably end up on the cutting room floor. So I was able to pull back some of those that I wanted to explore a little bit more.
And then Boy Mid-Flight, give us a little bit of insight into that one.
Boy Mid-Flight I wrote when I was 18, and it, you know, largely constructed from teenage diaries. Mm. So it's fiction, but it's, you know, pulled from a very real place from me. And it's, you know, it's a young man who is struggling again with coming out and, you know, moving from having a girlfriend to having a boyfriend and kind of figuring out what this whole, you know, what does love mean and what does love mean in a gay world? How do I fit into that?
As a creative, is there a preferred medium that you love to tell your stories? I mean, is it books? Is it film, TV? Is there something that really drives you?
You know, over the past few years, I've really been loving exploring documentary because behind the camera, in the director's chair, sitting across from a real person, having them share their real story with me, I find is just such a powerful thing. It's taught me a lot about active listening, which I think will be, you know, helpful for me as a performer as well, or going back into, you know, scripted TV or movies. But I don't know, Rick. Yeah, I like them all. You know, I call myself a storyteller, and sometimes there's different mediums that feel that they work better for different stories. So I bounce around, I play, and I don't always get it right, but I just keep doing it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up because in just the last few weeks, I've been doing some transitioning in my business platform and my platform that I use. And somebody said to me when I said, so what is Rick to you? Tell me, you know, brand Rick, what is that? And they said, you have the most unique ability to tell stories in everything you do. Whether it's your podcast, whether it's what you write, whether it's how you work with a client one-on-one, whether it's, you know, how you speak on stage, you have this beautiful ability to be a storyteller. And I never had really taken that in. And now that I heard it and listened and took it in, it's really allowed me to embrace that and go, yes, this is what I'm meant to do here. And now, of course, now I get to do the beautiful interviews with people like, and really bring out those pieces of the story so that others can hear it. Because I think that's when we can really have an impact on people's lives, is in the story that says, oh yeah, I can identify with that. It's so
absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think it is in those moments where we take the time to listen to each other. I mean, it's the oldest human tradition, sitting around a fire and singing a song or telling a story, right?
Yeah,
and empowering each other to do that, you know, and to give voice to the people who don't often, you know, get to share their voice, and giving
right.
them time, I think, is important. So keep doing what you're doing.
So I'm a little hesitant to say this because as soon as I put it out there, then somebody could nab it. But I feel comfortable saying it to you because if you nab it, I'd be totally cool with it. I've often felt it would be a powerful, powerful, powerful documentary to do a documentary around why people come out late in life and to box it into what does late in life really mean. And the reason I say that is as my book came out, what I was shocked by was the amount of people who have picked up my book, who are 20 something, late 20s, who say, oh yeah, I can relate to Frankly, My Dear, I'm Gay, a late bloomer's guide, because I'm coming out late in life. And of course, I'm sitting there going, wait, you're 20-something. But in their world, that seems really late to them. So I found it really interesting to start to see that show up in my world. And I think it could be a really interesting documentary. So there you go, Charlie.
Absolutely.
I'm giving that to you. Go run with it and see where it takes your creative mind.
I was just imagining somebody who's a little bit older, but pairing them with a younger person too, seeing that journey, you know, because I think sometimes when we come out later in life, suddenly it's like we're the kid in the candy store. We want to run around and read every book and watch every movie and dive into the club scene and do all the things that we haven't permitted ourselves to until that moment. You know, I turned 36 this year and I feel like I'm in this interesting middle place where now, as I've mentioned a few times, I'm speaking with younger people all the time. And I mean, half the time, I don't even know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Exactly.
Have shifted so much already. It's a little bit like feeling like the rug is pulled out from under you.
Yep.
And so I can only imagine being, you know, a decade or two senior than myself or more than that, what that journey must be like. I think
it's amazing. I was just having this conversation with a couple of my gay friends. I was in LA 2 days ago and we were talking about kind of the middle, the 30s through 40s kind of area where you're not your 20s. You're not in your 50s. You haven't become like the older generation yet. And there's this weird space where it's like the stories that show up in the 30s and 40s range is so interesting because people are in transition. Careers are either going on the rocks or second careers are starting and you're settling into relationships or maybe you're just coming out of your first, you know, relationships. It's such an interesting dynamic and it's so powerful. Just watch people in that arena. So I have one last question I always ask every one of my guests, and I think you probably have a really interesting perspective on this. If you could leave the listeners who are, like I said, maybe still in the closet, in the midst of starting the coming out process, been out a little bit of time, maybe quite a few years, if you could leave them with some really powerful words of wisdom about the journey, what would you love to leave them with?
I think I would suggest that just for a few moments, let go of the worry about what the family is going to think, what coworkers are going to think, what the neighbors are going to think. And just love yourself and love yourself fully. You know, embrace that part of you that has been so scary for so long, that's made you feel different and alone and judged and maybe hated and ridiculed. And take that part and, you know, cherish it because that is you. That's what makes you so unique and so special. And once you can give that part of you a hug and pull it into yourself, becoming your full authentic self, that's the armor that is going to carry you forward. Yeah. So you can stand tall with dignity and come out and present yourself as this is me world. So that will carry you far.
That's awesome. Beautiful words of wisdom, man. And I just want to say thank you again, Charlie, for carving out time out of your beautiful, busy schedule to come be on the show with us. It means a lot to me. It means the world to me. So I appreciate it, Matt.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
Yeah, it's been fun. And I just want to say, folks, if you've been listening and you know where we are just a couple of weeks away from the 100th episode of the Coming Out Lounge. And Charlie was kind of the cue up for getting us ready. He is show number 97. That means we're just three away. And I want to say how thankful I am to have this platform and this opportunity to bring beautiful people like Charlie to this medium to hopefully touch somebody and help somebody who's in the closet trying to find themselves or just coming through those closet doors. And to be able to say, it's okay, it's safe, and you're going to be just fine. So if you've enjoyed everything that we've done today or anytime we've done anything, you know how to do it. Give us some love on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever we're at. Find me out there on Facebook. Everything for Charlie will be on the show page where you can connect and see his films, his books, all this beautiful work that he's doing. And with that, I'm just going to leave it this week with, I want you to really be your own shining star. Step in front of those cameras of your life and step into telling your story your way, because guess what? You're the only one who can tell that story. You're the only one who can live that story. You're the only one who can be that story. And with that, we're going to wrap it up with this episode of the Coming Out Lounge. I'm Rick Clemens, the Coming Out Coach, and you've been listening to the Coming Out Lounge. Catch you in just a week. Take care, everyone. Hey, 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 closet dwellers and Coming Out Lounge listeners. I wanted to invite you to check something out. You know, for all the years that I've been a Coming Out coach, one thing I've learned is sometimes people come to do the work with me and they only need a little bit of help to get over something very particular and very important to them. It could be reconciling their religion and sexuality. Maybe it's learning how to have the difficult conversations where they say, I'm gay. Possibly it could be, oh my God, I'm out of the closet, but now how do I do this same-sex dating and mating sort of thing? Well, what I can tell you is throughout the years, there are common things that show up over and over and over again. And what I've heard most from my clients and listeners of the podcast is, I want a way to work with you just on these particular subjects. Yay, I am so excited because I've taken the action and I've made this possible. So how do you find out about these particular programs? You go to thecomingoutcoach.com, or if you're on the show page right now listening to the podcast or have just listened to the podcast, over to the right-hand side of the podcast description, everything is an icon that says one-on-one coaching sessions. Click on that button. You'll be taken to a page that describes each of the different 9 sessions I'm offering. They are one-on-one sessions that we can do via phone, Skype, or even FaceTime. They're very action-oriented. We go right to the topic that you want to talk about. And each of these sessions also includes a copy of my book, Frankly, My Dear, I'm Gay. So what more could you ask for? You get me for 90 minutes devoted to you, plus my book. So go check it out. See if there's something that could help you as you step out, step up, and step in to living your powerful truth. Take care. I'm Rick Clemons, the Coming Out Coach. I look forward to working with you.
You've just experienced the Coming Out Lounge. Go online to www.comingoutlounge.com to learn more. And tune in again next week for more stories and tips for being true to yourself.